spent 5 years in jail. I'm going to give you one last thing so that you'll be able to get the real story of McCarthyism, which is reviving again in USA. It's a review of the book, The Great Fear, The Anti-Communist Purge Under the Truman and Eisenhower Administrations, Both Democrat and Republican, by David Kaut, C-A-U-T-E, Simon & Schuster, New York, 1977, $12.95. We can't afford it, so we'll just try to, I'll try to give you some excerpts. And the stereotypes then prevalent to be a communist in the 50s was, as Murray Kempton noted, rather like being a child molester. Communists were perceived as the amoral agents of a China-Soviet-led world conspiracy that sought to subvert the American way of life in order to destroy the American nation and the free world, and in turn is returned upon the scene in an anti-Soviet hysteria. Anti-communism became as much a unifying ideology in the Cold War America as anti-Semitism, that means anti-Jewish feeling, was in Nazi Germany under Hitler, as tolerated dissenters, self-styled socialists, and independent radicals often went to outrageous extremes to show their opposition to the Communist Party in order to distinguish their policies from those whom the dominant media portrayed as tainted carriers of the political plague. In the U.S. today, although the same social groupings who created the post-World War II anti-communist political repression remain in power, that repression is usually called McCarthyism and perceived increasingly by dominant media as the excess of right-wing politicians against liberal, though it is still just as severe as the McCarthyism of the 50s. Of right-wing politicians against liberals, former communists, and various political innocents caught in a wave of Cold War political hysteria. In The Great Fear, British scholar and novelist David Kaut has written the most important and comprehensive general history to date of the post-war oppressions, challenging both the old shibboleths, S-H-I-B-B-O-L-E-T-H-S, of the Cold War period and the more contemporary whitewashing by selective anti-McCarthyism. By setting the record straight, David Kaut continues the struggle against Cold War ideology and political terrorism that's going on in U.S. imperialism. First, Kaut removes McCarthy and his allied rightist politicians from center stage and replaces them with top national leadership and police authorities at all levels of government. The Cold War intellectuals and trade unionists who, for various reasons, either collaborated with or actively joined the witch hunts and the businessmen and conservative elites through the society who championed and profited from widespread violations of civil liberties and democratic rights. Second, Kaut organizes and synthesizes material from many sources to show more fully than ever before how widespread the suppression really was, making factory workers and public school teachers as significant as university professors and show business celebrities in its accounts. Finally, Kaut, unlike most American sources, treats communists both as political activists, as victims of political oppression. By the way, our good friend Harvey Milk was just simply devastated and charged with all kinds of heinous crimes because of his open admission of homophobic activity. He's a supervisor in San Francisco. We need to write him lots of letters. He was terribly, terribly maligned by a gentleman he had a TV debate with. I can't think of some bangs or something of that sort, who is now ordering an anti-homosexual bill that no homosexual will be able to hold any job. Snyder attacks on all communists as Stalinists who mirrored the values of their political enemies on the right. Guilt-ridden sentimentality about communists as noble, romantic idealists mizzled into heroic action, and attacks on Communist Party policy as betrayals of true Marxism are as refreshingly absent from The Great Fear as they are predictably present in the most American literature of the subject. But Kaut's work contains significant flaws. He fails to provide the necessary historical background on American class. Stand by for a moment for questions. But Kaut's work to contain significant flaws, about through. He fails to provide the necessary historical background on the American class conflict in the 1930s, or to understand the significance of victories won by communists and allied left militants in the trade unions and the mass protest organizations. These victories gave the communist left an important base, making it both a significant thorn in the side of the capitalist class in the U.S. and potential threat to post-war plans to restructure and stabilize fascism in the U.S. and worldwide, although those forces are now weakening. Kautsky perceives the Cold War in conventional categories of Soviet-American rivalry, failing to grasp the extent to which the post-war power vacuum represented a profound revolutionary crisis for world capitalism, a crisis where only the U.S. had the power to act quickly to defend capitalist world interests, thus, in fact, de facto fascist interests. Kautsky fails to portray adequately the resistance of communists and those on the left who refuse to collaborate with the forces of oppression, bravely so. The still little-known history of that resistance that is gone now from the American mood, even with its limited achievements, deserves to be considered as a remarkable chapter in the history of the American left, as a significant backdrop to the civil rights and anti-war movements which did so much to break down the Cold War consensus in the 1960s, which is now rebuilding here in 1978. These criticisms, however, in no way detract from the enormous gains represented by Kautsky's book. By setting a lot of the historical record straight, Kautsky has made a valuable contribution to the continuing struggle against Cold War ideology and domestic political terrorism that is at work more active today than it was in McCarthyism, a struggle that is as important today in the America of Jimmy Carter and Zbigniew Brzezinski, who really controlled through the Trilateral Commission, is at any time since the early 1950s. This is just a brief synopsis. Remember, we're having our Soviet classes at 7:30. Also practice what you will be saying to guests who come in. How you enjoy it here. We have protein daily, all the beautiful food, and never complain. You tell them how you would not consider going back to America. Someone would give you $1 million. You don't want anything to do with it. This is a required understanding that the CIA can infiltrate, not through the Russians, but others who will be coming. The other people did not come so far in. They only came up, the guests came only a short distance. But I still hold the same demand that these people who are at the entrance be given a slip of paper written up, typewritten on what they're to say, exactly what they're to do, very warmly and very courteously, and these people must take a one-day public service program. They must have some educational experience because this is uncalled for. We need to know who is coming in our entrance. It's essential. And we're grateful to Brother Parr. He's been thinking along lines of security. And we want to be assured that we have this. The Guyana Defense Force has been very helpful. The very good friend, Commander Price, who is head of all the Naval, the Army, the Air Force of the Guyana Defense Force, is a friend of ours, and he has increased the protection around us. But we still cannot be too careful. Everyone should always have an eye for that lone sniper that could try to sneak in or something of that sort. And we must have complete legitimate reporting. And as the person goes by without them noting it, take the license number of the car, just in case that someone comes who represents himself being one thing and then something else. We have to take certain procedures. Precaution is necessary, though we're in the safest place in the world this time. We want to be sure that we take every precaution necessary. Again, I want more smiling and more friendliness. Tomorrow when the Soviets come, there must be greetings of Zdravstvuyte, Tavarish, and the greeting for hello. You can see them. They're to be, I don't yet see them on the sign. They're to be put in the pavilion in prominent showing. The Soviets' word should be put in the pavilion in prominent showing, indicating that we are learning. Or at least they should be put in the library, because they would go in and just see Swahili, Chinese, and Spanish, and which, by the way, you have no Portuguese. It would not be, it would be considered an affront. And we should have more Soviets than anything because they have been good to us. Thank you very much, and we'll see you at the 7:30 meeting on Russian language. Much love.
Attention. I thought I'd give a little Soviet history, and maybe Don, Tom Grubbs, Trop, Dick Trop could step up and give some favorite sayings of Lenin and Brezhnev, as far as that goes, and Marx, and put them around at various places. Any sayings. Would you please take that burden off me, because I've had no rest and I need your assistance in that matter. I'm going to give you a little Soviet history so that the children can be drilled, particularly in PATS and other areas where I stop children. During the 9th and 12th centuries, Slavic land-tilling tribes inhabited a vast time property inequality led to the social inequality when the feudal aristocracy and its leaders, the princes, seized the rights of the land and to the labor and even personal freedom of the peasant. Rus proper became the nucleus of the Russian lands territorially, economically and politically. 13th century. Rus, R-U-S, broke up into 14 principalities and regions. The internecine wars between tribes and peoples, that is, that broke out at that time coincided, went together with the invasion of the nomadic hordes led by the Mongol Khans, which wrought devastation to European civilization. Rus bore the brunt achieved. 14th and 16th centuries. The national revival was the direct result of the emergence of the centralized Russian state, which rallied the lands of the Great Russia, the Ukraine, and Belarusia into a political and territorial entity. It's Great Russia, centralized Russian state, shrouded the lands of Great Russia and Ukraine and Byelorussia. That's B-Y-E-L-O-R, then Russia, R-U-S-S-I-A, into a political and territorial entity. This state took the lead in the struggle against the Golden Horde, and subsequently mustered the efforts of the Russian nation to overcome its impoverishment brought about by the military intervention by Poland and Sweden early in the 17th century. The new centralized state also helped restore Russia's prestige in the eyes of other countries. 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. Having crushed the First Peasant War, the big landowners, the Tsar, T-S-A-R, the nobility, and the clergy set themselves up as an unchallenged rulers, as the unchallenged rulers of the country. The period saw the rapid development of cities and trade with the emergence, that means coming forward, of capitalist relationships. Russia now found parts of the European economic system. The Tsar, T-S-A-R, wielded unlimited power over the entire country. The triumph of absolutism was complete in the days of Peter the Great and Catherine the Second. Those are past leaders of pre-revolutionary Russia. The reforms introduced by the monarchs of Russia did not change the feudal socio-political system of the country, which with the advent of capitalism entered a period of social crises. The most notable of these were peasant wars led by Yemelyan, Y-E-M-E-L-Y-A-N, Pugachev, P-U-G-A-C-H-E-V, Europe's biggest, the uprising of the Decembrists, D-E-C-E-M-B-R-I-S-T-S, 1825, and the socio-political movement of the Revolutionary Democrats, the emancipation of the peasants from feudal suppression became inevitable. Continuing. Stand by for just a moment.
Okay.
1861, the abolition of serfdom in Russia marked the beginning of a new epoch, a new period, the transition from feudalism to capitalism. There was a rapid development of industry, emergence, that means coming forward, of a proletariat, working class, and a capitalist class, and an intensification of social contradictions. That's Soviet term that you might remember. An intensification of social contradictions. A working class emerged on the political scene and the ideas of Marx began to gain ground. Karl Marx, you know, is a writer of Das Kapital. He, with Engels, helped form the great book Das Kapital about socialism, about communism, which we would have never known. Marxist thought started with Karl Marx. He was 1848. Anyway, a working class emerged on the political scene in the class. The ideas of Marxism began to gain ground. 1895, the League of Struggle for the Emancipation of the Working Class, the embryo, that's like the part of the egg where the baby is just beginning to form, of the Revolutionary Party of the Proletariat, the working class, was organized in Lenin's initiative. Marxist ideas root in the working class. Remember, Lenin had to live several years in exile, just as we are, before he was able to free his country. 1905-1907, the bourgeoisie, democratic revolution in Russia, the first such revolution ever to take place in the period, epoch of imperialism. The mass of the people, headed by the proletariat, which was guided by a revolutionary party constituted, made up its driving force. 1914-1917, the First World War brought all the contradictions of imperialism, all of them, to a head and accelerated, or sped up. That's what it means when you accelerate, you put your foot on the accelerator of a car. It accelerated or sped up the general revolutionary crisis, which was at its most acute stage in Russia, 1914-1917. February 1917, the victory of the Second Bourgeoisie Democratic Revolution, the overthrow of the autocracy, and the beginning of the development, victory of the Second Bourgeoisie. You see, they had a revolution just before they had the Communist Revolution. February 1917, the Communist Revolution, October 1917, the victory of the Second Bourgeoisie Democratic Revolution in Russia, the overthrow of the autocracy, and the beginning of the development of the Bourgeoisie Democratic Revolution into a socialist revolution began. Now we go into the socialist era, the latter part. 1917. In October 1917, as a result of a socialist revolution, there emerged in Russia the world's first socialist state of workers and peasants. A new age was ushered in, the age of mankind's transition from capitalism to socialism, to a new order under which there is no exploitation, no one taking advantage of man by man. The proletariat, the working class of multinational origins of Russian background, blazed the trail to a vast new society. The 1920s and 1930s, industrialization, collectivism, that means like we have live here, collective farms, collectivism of agriculture, a cultural revolution, and an equitable, fair, sharing solution of the nationalities question turned the Soviet Union in a short space of time into a mighty socialist power. Its working people successfully managed the central and most difficult task of the socialist revolution, the task of construction. 1941-45, the horror period. Nazi Germany's treacherous attack on the USSR, as they were set up to do by U.S. monopoly capitalist interest and Churchill. It was even later brought out in British intelligence papers, you can remember. Interrupted the Soviet people in their peaceful work in the central, in the great patriotic war. The Soviet people not only defended their freedom and independence, but contributed decisively to the victory and the rescue of European and world civilization from fascism. And that they did. You can mention that they almost single-handedly stopped the vast German resistance at Stalingrad, and then the last stand at Berlin, when Churchill, at that late point, was offering a telegram to Hitler, which, you know, in Dresden, it shows that he danced up and down with Goebbels, his propaganda minister, that if he stopped the Russians, they would still negotiate a settlement where he could carry on his vicious Nazi regime, fascist, the last stage of capitalist regime, and his concentration camps. 1945, the 1950s, after acquiring themselves heroically in the Great Patriotic War, the Soviet people displayed similar dedication in the post-war reconstruction. The ruined towns and villages, farms and factories were quickly restored, but the entire industrial belt nearly and the entire agricultural belt nearly were destroyed. The 1950s to date, as a result of the Soviet people's efforts, a developed in socialist society has been built in the Soviet Union. Developed socialism implies the fusion of the scientific and technological revolution with the advantage of the socialist system. It means the creation of the material and technical base of communism, and a steady rise in living standards for all people. It is today supreme achievement of human social progress. There is no unemployment at all in the Soviet Union. There is no cost of living. In fact, it's gone down. That's the advantage. Free medicine, free dentistry, all those things. You should show some knowledge. If I were to stop and ask you some question, you should show some knowledge. This tape will be being played under the second tent. In a moment, I'm going to give the news of the day. I remember that the Soviet Union lost 20 to 22 million dead. 22 million of their citizens died. One in five died. One in five of every family, on an average, died. While USA suffered very little from the war. No bombings, no killing of civilians. So that's the heroism of the Soviet Union. That from October 1917, the great October Revolution under Lenin, that we can still see, remember, Lenin avant-garde. The Don can give these better. Now, if after I finish the news, Don would be so kind, and Trump. Have I begun?
Oh, yesterday. You want?
I better try it again.
Okay.
News of the day. Some briefly positive things in a world of much heavy news. Jobs for 140,000 people. New graduates of Ukrainian colleges and university people. Two of the estimated 50,000 marmots that inhabit the Kazakhstan area of the Soviet Union. The animals were in danger of disappearing until strict conservation laws were brought into effect. Similar conservation has been done in the Volga region, which has brought back fish that were nearly in extinction. Dolphins happy event. Vasila, a dolphin at the Batumi Aquarium, has given birth to a 32-pound baby. It was, if you'll excuse the expression, a boy, and the second she has given birth to in the dolphinarium. As you know, dolphins have the intelligence of man, almost, and some say they supersede man. I am sure that they would be, as gentle as they are, much more communistic than we see the world today. New air route open. Regular flights have been inaugurated from Moscow to Rovno in the Ukraine. Rovno is now linked by air to 28 cities. As you know, because of socialism, the Soviet airlines are able to furnish much cheaper rates to those who travel her lines. Tajik, leopard spotted, T-A-J-I-K. Leopards have been spotted for the first time in 16 years in the Tajikistan mountains. The animals are protected by a strict nature and conservancy laws, which are not regarded in the imperialist circles, as you know. Scientists lift a 200-year-old shell aboard the Soviet research ship Kolesov, which has just returned to Vladivostok after a long research voyage in the Pacific. The ship reached the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, where it studied the coral reefs and how they protect themselves. The scientists are hoping that studies there will help them to provide protection for other organisms on marine shells. The shell and other discoveries are now being studied at Marine Biology National Institute. Adventists, which are known as Sabbatarians, are Seventh-day worshippers. Seventh-day Adventists visit fellow believers in the Soviet Union. It's good news to hear that they are on a positive note there. We have known them always to be more conservative, if not reactionary, and often very racistic in the USA. A Seventh-day Adventist delegation has been visiting the Soviet Union as guests of believers in the great USSR. Mr. Robert Pearson, president of the General Conference of the Seventh-day Adventists, said he had been greatly impressed by his first visit to the USSR. They had seen whatever they wanted, gone wherever they had liked. They could see the Soviet Constitution was right in saying there was no state interference in religious affairs, of course, elementary to those who know socialism. During their visit, the delegation attended religious services in Kyiv and Odessa. As you remember, not too long back, Muhammad Ali came back and said that the Soviet Union was the most beautiful country, the least racist country he had ever seen, and got in a bit of trouble with his fellow Muslim believers for praising it higher than he did Mecca in the Saudi Arabia. Canada car contracts are being made with the USSR. Lada, the first consignment of Lada cars for sale in Canada, has arrived by ship in Montreal. The contract for the supply of Lada cars is the biggest contract for the sale to Canada of Soviet industrial products. Lada cars have been tested in tough Canadian winter conditions for 2 years and have passed the most rigorous test. We'll go on to the usual news now. All forms of education and training are free of charge in the great country of our spiritual motherland, the USSR. Electronic devices get water to the cotton fields, a new device employed. This helps to save water in the Arab areas and at the same time to increase the harvest by 10%. Some is a little difficult for me to listen and hear and relate because the static is considerable. So I'll try to make as much sense out of the news as possible. Estimated irrigation system has appeared in all of the major Soviet areas. I believe that's what it's saying. The government allocated additional funds for constructing them, the Soviet government, that is. Land improvement in the country is financed by the government and the grain land is handed over to the farmers. Collectives are encouraged like ours in the Soviet Union. That's why it would be heaven on earth, paradise for us to be living in such an environment where the entire society supports a way of life rather than finding yourself, though with tremendously fine Marxist in the leadership in this country, nonetheless the people not as aware or as supportive of collectivism as they should be. The government has taken new steps to develop handcrafts of small nationalities, from small nationalities. It opened a school also in a small nationality, of which I count here, where young people can study the traditional art of wood and ivory carving. In the Soviet Union, much attention is given to promoting the handcrafts, an emphasis like ours, perhaps, on work study, where we spend time with the academics. All of us learn in group settings at night, joyously, rather than by any kind of compulsion or compulsory nature, instead of like in USA, where we saw people glued to the television and made passive robots. The Soviet Union have well-equipped shops and schools for trained artists. The government-owned shops and museums produced by the handicraftsmen and are high and guaranteed prices are upheld by the Soviet government. Increased to its workers in response to demand. Stand by. In response to demand of more than 25%. I can hardly imagine demand of workers' needs. There is demand perhaps for production. This is what it means, because Soviet unions, trade unions are free, autonomous, and no need for strikes exists in the Soviet Union as guaranteed employment, recreation, and all other benefits, social benefits that we have to fight so hard to get for our people and our neighbors, free medicine, dental care, all those things are free from the cradle to the end of life. By the way, a news break. The new Pope, who was considered anti-communist, has just died of a heart attack. It seems Rome was having some trouble to find a successor to the seat of St. Peter. We are always sorrowed when a human being passes from the scene. We hope that this will be at least an opportunity out of this painful grief that a more progressive pope like Pope John, who was known as the Pope of Peace, will be reinstated. advocate for coexistence and so forth will be elected. Carter's meeting today with elements of the Trilateral Commission. As you know, in the United States, the Trilateral Commission and Brezhnev, the chief aide to the president, security head, is really the power behind the scenes. We have reliable information from Harper's and Playboy, both what you would consider capitalist organs, stating that it was a shoe-in for Brzezinski, who is a neo-fascist, who talks of genocide in open terms. Jokingly, he spoke of leaving a circle to go to speak with some people in his office about genocide. He has, in his books, advocated a kind of Superman position. He is also an advocate, like People's China, gone mad by the doctrine of three worlds, that nuclear war is inevitable, to talk in terms that nuclear war, said Brzezinski, chief aide to President Carter, is certainly acceptable means of warfare and defending democracy, so-called, joke, the ruling class, he should have said. He should have said ethnocentric in the first place, which shows his ignorance. Newspapers seem to agree that the purpose of the meeting of the heads of the Security Council, this is another bit of news, is to head off Zambian anger over the oil sanctions scandal. The Daily Express of London says that meeting will be a humiliating experience for Mr. Callaghan, the Prime Minister of the Labour Party. The Daily Telegram describes the British Prime Minister's visit to wherever I cannot decipher as a pilgrimage. The paper says that some other person is desperately anxious to end the Rhodesian upheaval, which has almost ruined Zambia. Said that he and the British American government are prisoners of the African militants. Well, that's, of course, an interesting bit of news, that he and the Americans are victims of the African militants. It is the Americans and her imperialist lackeys through NATO that are stirring up the African cauldron. They suggest that two leaders should be looking for a new, more realistic plan for solving the Rhodesian problem, Carter and Callaghan, that is, on terms which will enable the whites to remain in Rhodesia and in, I don't catch this word, I presume it must mean South Africa. The Times says that Mr. Callaghan will not be going to Nigeria if he did not think it was of the greatest importance to British interest to give President of Nigeria prompt and public satisfaction. Nigeria has been moving more and more independent of Western imperialist circles. It's an oil-rich nation of OPEC, as you know. African accusations say that Britain was all along on Smith's side, as has been reported repeatedly by socialist circles. Since UDI and the row over the oil sanctions make it hard to counter such accusations, though they are mistaken and must be denied, the Times says that Britain will be under pressure for a new and real British commitment to bring Smith down. I would think so, when the Zimbabwean Patriotic Front under Robert Mugabe, nationalist, and rather Robert Mugabe, Marxist-Leninist, and Joshua Nkoma, nationalist, represents 97% of the people of Zimbabwe. Another paper said a minority government in Britain will have to rule out the use of force for this purpose. The Guardian has editorialized on the Israel attitude of the outcome of the Camp David summit, or should we say sellout, on the Middle East. There's been irate reaction, even in the reactionary regime of the Shah of Iran. All through the Arab world, there's deep resentment that Zionist, expansionist Israel and Egypt saw more or less a satellite, a puppet of U.S. imperialism, and USA had the audacious nerve to negotiate the West Bank, which was taken by force from Jordan, and Lebanon, South Lebanon, which is occupied by the aggressively neo-fascist Zionist state. It is unfortunate that the Jewish people, which have been in the past some of the greatest friends of change, were led astray by the capitalist trick of Zionism. The Guardian, Manchester Guardian, I presume, writes almost everything that Begin has said since the signing of the agreement has been to provoke the Arab opponents or humiliate Mr. Sadat. He urged to, I don't catch it, I'm trying to listen and tell you at the same time, he urged that things are irresistible by his continued assertion of Israeli presence in occupied Arab territory. Begin, who I would call, to be kind, reactionary Prime Minister of Israel, seems determined to go on poisoning the world. The Guardian advises the Israelis not to push their luck. The paper says that the Camp David agreement, represented in the ultimate in what President Sadat could give Israel, gave the agreement the most liberal interpretation in favor of the Palestinians. This is, of course, capitalistic news, and you have to read between the lines. Obviously, Israel has not given any concession in the situation. The liberal male, who carries a large feature face page, report from a correspondent in Nicaragua. There has been 10 days of armed rebellion against the country's military regime. The article is headed, "The Ruthless Revenge of General Somoza," who, by the way, is continually to being backed up by military, with military hardware, by multinationals from you-know-where, Washington. And the article described aerial and arterial bombardment by his fascist government forces. Somoza has been in power for 44 years after a U.S. Marine invasion of that country. It goes on to describe, as I said, bombardment by government forces against densely populated towns. Whole sections of the towns are said to be burning, gutted, and stinking with corpses. The Morning Star comments on Nicaragua. The paper says that despite President Carter's interest in so-called, we should say, in human rights, if he really were interested in human rights, he would do something about the numerous thousands, as in a moment of truth, Andrew Young said, were in our own political jails, as well as the Wilmington 10, who are glaringly political prisoners, and the Puerto Ricans that have been kept for 30 years for their resistance to occupation, really, by a foreign power. Puerto Rico was invaded by the United States. They wish their independence. For the most part, polls show that they do not wish to be a state of the United States. His only intervention in Nicaragua has been to suggest, Carter's is, that is, that General Somoza should exercise control over the murdering troops. Well, that's not hear the radio very clearly. I believe this is a correspondent, foreign correspondent for New York. Often the foreign issues of U.S. journals are a little bit more honest and, should we say, liberal than those for U.S. consumption. An American journalist in the New York Times is visiting Nicaragua, and he said that the USA is offering, the government is offering, more military aid to the regime. But the Costa Rican people have bravely withstood all efforts to get them involved, though it seemed their government was being attempted to be manipulated by the USA and her lackeys into the horrible, barbaric murder of the citizenry of Nicaragua. The main points of the news: the foreign secretary, and I believe that's Dr. Owens, I can't hear clearly, are leaving London this a.m. to meet the president of Zambia. The meeting will take place in Nigeria, and Rhodesia and Libya are expected to be the main topics. Israeli Prime Minister Mr. Begin says there have been general misunderstandings on the part of the Camp David agreements dealing with Israeli settlements of the West Bank. Mr. Begin, dictator of Zionist Israel, and that's my own subjective feeling, who is now on his way home, will have a talk with Mr. Callahan. Though do not underestimate the number of laboring class Jews in Israel who oppose the Begin policies. Moves are being made to unite dissidents in Eastern Europe, and Polish and Czechoslovakian activists have announced plans for an international something. I wish I could hear it. An international symposium or something. It is not clear. The Organization of American States has begun discussing the crisis in Nicaragua. The Organization of American States is considering sanctions. Nigeria has lifted a state of emergency which has been in force for 12 years. They're, as you know, promising new elections. Let us hope. Let us hope. It appears likely that the president will use his authority under existing law to declare a national emergency, which of course he has right at his fingertips, just as all of the pseudo-democracies have, as Hitler had when he set up the interesting situation in Germany by taking a mental patient out of a Dutch hospital, placing him at the Reichstag, his secret police, the Gestapo that is, and putting oil cans around him, combustible instruments, and then setting fire to the Reichstag, the parliament building in Germany. And as you know, he was also accused of being this mental case of being a communist. This happened after even Hitler had been named.